My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is a founding member of the Invictus Games. His story and how he got to that point is nothing less than both horrendous and inspiring. Mass murder, getting shot, climbing mountains, I am undefeated. From Helmand to the Himalayas, episode 12, David Wiseman. This is Declassified. Send help. British troops are dying. Was the message your ops room received while she served in Afghanistan on the 3rd of November 2009? And from that message, I just want you to take it from there.
Yeah, so we were back at forward operating base, Shawkat, in the middle of Helmand Province, Nadi Ali district. And we'd come back in to drop off one of the lads to pick up his R&R flight. And our company sergeant major, Chuck Berry, just come running out of the ops room and sort of grabbed me. And so I said, you've got to get to Blue 25. Got to get to the police station. It's all kicking off. And I was like, you know, what's happening? He said, and he relayed that radio message to me and said, that's all we've got. Can you get there? Hmm. So I was just running back to our vehicles and my small team. My platoon sergeant had already got that message, and the troops were scurrying around getting.
How many's in that team?
We were what's called an omelet, an operational mentor liaison team. So there'll have been seven of us there.
Yeah. Okay.
At that point, scurrying around, getting the vehicle sorted, and sort of as soon as I got there, threw on my body armor, picked up my weapon, smashed on my helmet, and we were out the gate. I was sort of trying to get information off the ops room on the way over the net, over the radio, and there was no information. And at the same time, I was trying to stay off the net because, you know, as you know, if there's something kicking off, you've got to keep the net clear. So people can use it for you know, the emergency. But I was thirsty for information, so I knew what I was.
And you were flying down the road, kind of the track.
Yeah.
Vehicles, yeah.
Yeah, we were sort of doing Mach 10, and we got there, still had no other information other than, you know, that there were British casualties, not how many or what had happened or anything. So as we pulled up, we stopped short maybe, I don't know, 250 metres of the police station, right at the edge of this large village, small town called Shinkalay. And we stopped, and I could see there were a couple of lads on the roof, British soldiers on the roof of the police station, firing out to the north. So in my head, I'm sort of thinking, okay, well, there's been a contact. They've picked up some casualties, you know, a casualty, one casualty, two casualties, whatever. They've been shot. Contact's still on. No worries. We'll support from our position. And then we'll go through and pick up the casualties and extract road move back to Shawkat. Like, you know, it's okay. We can sort that. Edged one of my vehicles forward. It was a small Land Rover sort of thing, you know. It's not like it wasn't a tank. Yeah. It was a Wimmick. So basically a Land Rover with a GPM, a general purpose machine gun on the back. Edged that forward so I could bring the gun to bear, push one of my corporals forward into some cover so he could get some eyes on and report back. Couldn't really see anything. And at the same time, I could see the lads on the roof sort of like beckoning me and sort of really, really enthusiastically sort of go, get over here, get over here. I was thinking, this is weird. And I was like, well, why do they want me over there? Surely I'm best positioned here. But
because the police kind of station is essentially a British base as well, isn't it? It's not like it's just a police station in the middle of nowhere. We have British troops in that police station.
Okay, so so my job as a OMLT commander, mentor liaison team commander, was to be embedded within the Afghan National Army.
Yeah.
So that's why we had such a small team. There were only 9 of us in the team, 7 of us on this particular patrol. We sort of lived alongside, worked alongside, fought alongside our Afghan National Army colleagues.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
The guys in the police station, they were doing exactly the same job,
yeah,
but with the Afghan National Police Force.
I'm with you.
So, yeah, small team in there mentoring the police. So, yeah, they were sharing that facility with the police.
Yep.
So, anyway, these two guys, British guys, on the roof, beckoning, saying, you know, come over, and shouting. So they were 250 metres away, so I couldn't really make it out. But it was obvious that it was urgent. I grabbed my medic, a guy called Manny, a Ghanaian lad. And by the way, this was his second ever patrol in the British Army.
Yeah.
You know, ever. You know, he was brand new, straight out of the packet. And I grabbed him and went, right, this casualty's in there, you're with me. And we ran that 250 metres, probably not the most sensible thing to do. But just by the nature of the roads, actually moving vehicles around there would have been slow if there was RPG or machine gun fire or whatever. We had no armour, so running probably was the best thing to do.
Yeah.
So we legged it straight into the police station. It's a walled compound, so the wall, you know, typical Afghan sort of 8-9 feet high wall.
So for you, you're going into safety now, essentially.
Yeah, we've just done a 250 meter mad dash over, you know, no cover. You know, what we can see is potential enemy to the north. So we've just legged it over there, all our kit. You know, 250 meters is a long way in that heat and with all that kit. And so we're like, you know, brilliant, good, you know, checking behind me, make sure Manny's all right. And he's there with me. And straight away in the courtyard behind the wall, there's this lad on the floor, British soldier, young bloke, blood everywhere. His trousers are drenched, absolutely drenched. And I can see blood splatter on the wall. And I can see sort of his eye is closed. And I'm thinking, right, well, okay, he's been shot in the legs. Yeah. And he's fallen over and he's hit his face on there. Okay, let's sort him out. He's still conscious. He's still with us. So me and Manny start putting tourniquets on his legs. He'd been shot a lot of times in his legs, 5 times as it turned out. Mm. So we're tourniqueting up his legs to stop, you know, what is a catastrophic bleed, something that you can die from very, very quickly. And I'm sort of, after I've done that, I sort of hold his hand a bit and I'm like, you're all right, mate. We're going to sort you out, don't worry. And he sort of says, oh, can you let go of my hand? And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, no worries. And he went, my arms are broken. And I sort of look at his arms and he's got a gunshot wound through both arms. And I'm looking at his eye and it's closed completely. And I'm thinking that's where he's fallen over and hit his eye. He'd been shot through the eye as well. He'd taken 7 rounds. I was thinking, where is everybody else? You know, this is a busy, you know, platoon base, the police station. This is, where is everybody? where's the reception party? You know, we've got two guys on the roof, but maybe they're out on patrol or whatever. I couldn't figure out how this lad had been shot so many times. And so I leave Manny with this soldier, British soldier, and I go round the corner of the police station, and I couldn't believe what was there, to be honest. I stood there, like, aghast. And there was just dead bodies. Just dead bodies.
Fuck.
There were three all piled on top of each other. There was another sort of leaning back on the steps, and then there was another guy who was still alive. A lot of injuries to his abs. And I was sort of standing there just looking at it. And then Manny comes around the corner, and he's like, I can't really, would have said something like, "Sir, boss, you know, what's, and then he just stopped. And I don't know how long we stood there, just going, you know, what on earth is going on? But I remember just snap backed into it. And as callous as it sounds and as callous as it was, I grabbed Manny, like physically grabbed him around the collar and went, "Listen, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead, he's alive." And I pushed him, like physically, like pushed him to this guy with the ab injuries.
And these are all British soldiers?
All British soldiers.
Yeah.
And all been shot a lot of times at close range. I mean...
Why were they all together?
So, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, but from what we've been told, they'd come in off patrol, and had all sat down with their backs to the wall, you know, and they'd opened up, you know, lads' mags and brought out the cigarettes, and they were sitting there having a read and a smoke and a laugh, and that's where they were attacked. But the back wall, from where they had their backs to, and then the compound wall, it was sort of like, I don't know, 4 or 5 meters. So it couldn't have been any further away than that from where they were shot. So now I was sort of like, wow, they've been shot from inside the compound. What the hell is going on? Am I safe? Are the lads safe? And at this point, my platoon sergeant comes in. He also did, you know, he must have followed up sort of like a couple of minutes behind us on the mad dash across the ground, and he was there in the corner, like looking at all this, and then Manny, as he's working on this lad, sort of looked across at the three guys who were sort of stacked on top of each other. And he said, "Sir, that guy's not dead." And me and Coops sort of, bless him, my platoon sergeant, Coops. I mean, he didn't hesitate. He just stepped forward and was like, "Right, sir, let's get this lad out." And we'll probably talk about this in a bit, but I felt horrendous that I hesitated.
I felt
he was a young, very young lad.
Yeah.
Who was underneath two dead guys, and I hesitated about getting him out because I just didn't want to touch.
Because it was so horrendous.
And so we sort of moved the guys and pulled this lad out and did what we could for him, but everyone there in that group had been shot in the head and a lot of times in the body, and there was nothing we could do for him. And he died very shortly afterwards, but
the young lad.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, nobody who was against that wall survived, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But we did, you know, we did all the best we could for them. But yeah, that was I'd say that was the worst part of the whole day, was just, you know, trying to help that lad.
That lad.
And yeah. But at that point we I was thinking, crikey, how has this happened? Where is everybody? And where's the perpetrator? Where's the enemy? And at that point, it sounds really weird, mate. You know, people started coming out of the police station.
Brits. Yeah.
No, first of all, an Afghan. Three Afghan policemen came out. One had been shot in the thigh. And they started coming out of the police station. And I screamed at them. Like, shouldered my weapon straight up. And just every swear word known to man came out of my lips.
Yeah.
Because I was like, right, well, you know, who's been killing these British soldiers? You know, there's only a few people in the compound who could have got in the compound and done this. It's going to be this, what we call a green on blue, you know, where, you know, friendly forces, open up on Brits. So I go absolutely nuts on these guys. And poor bloke, I mean, he'd already been shot in the leg, right at the top of the thigh. So he had a serious injury. And I'm there, like, screaming at him and making sure they're not armed, making sure that me and the blokes aren't in danger. And then we sorted him out. And then I'm thinking, well, who else is coming out of the woodwork? And it starts getting really strange. So two more guys, British soldiers now, come out of the police station. Both of them in states of battle shock.
We'll elaborate on that.
Yeah. They were there, but they're basically, their brains had taken too much.
Yeah.
And had basically just checked out temporarily.
Yeah.
So the first one was almost completely aware of the situation, but unaware of his surroundings. So he was stepping over his friends.
Yeah.
And like, almost not taking it in, and just wrapping his arms around me, floods of tears. And I don't know why. I mean, I was a captain at the time. He was a guardsman. I don't know why it came. I just thought, you know, I remember saying, you know, don't worry, mate. My name's David.
Yeah.
You know, don't worry. You know, we'll sort you out. I don't know why. I just didn't feel that rank was into play. And I know, you know, you served yourself, mate. You were in the engineers, and that would have been quite weird, wouldn't it, for a captain to say to a private soldier, "Oh, hi, I'm
especially
David."
You didn't know each other, and
oh yeah, we didn't, mate. Yeah, all that sort of thing. It'd be weird. But and then another guy came out, and he was just in his boxer shorts, you know, and he was unaware of surroundings, and he was stepping over his mates, and just wandering around. And I remember him asking me, where's the exit? You know, oh, hello, sir, where's the exit?
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, he just gone. So I'm thinking, shit, you know, I need to secure this building. I need to know.
How long has it been then since you entering God the compound? Knows.
I don't know, mate.
Minutes?
Yeah. Minutes for you.
Yeah.
But you know, like any of these things, it seems, you know, I've heard you on previous podcasts before about talking about sort of memory issues, and we all know sort of like when you're in a high tempo situation, traumatic incident, time just goes a bit weird.
Mm.
Memories go a bit weird. Everything gets jumbled up and so it's difficult to say how long it was. But, I've got to clear this building. So I step inside and there's a fire. There's a small fire, and it's a horrible fire. It's basically the radio equipment.
Mm.
So, you know, one of the one of the cracking soldiers at the facility obviously put a FOSS grenade on the comms equipment.
So basically a really hot grenade, essentially, to get rid of the communication.
Yeah, because that's like, you know, it's super secret squirrels kit. And you don't want that falling into
anything. So in amongst all this, someone there's super professional has gone, I need to sort this kit out because we might get overrun or whatever.
Exactly. Someone's had the mindset to go, right, I need to get rid of this.
That's unreal.
That's proper professionalism. Very good soldiering. But, you know, the smell of it, I can sort of taste it now and smell it now in the back of my throat, that acrid, burning metal smoke.
Yeah.
And the ground was like... It was slick. A lot of
is it dark in there?
It's pitch black except for this fire. I'm sort of clearing these rooms on my own.
Why is it? Sorry, mate. You just said so. Why is it slippy?
Just a lot of people have been shot in there.
Right.
And
blood.
Yeah. And there were sort of. I got to the end of this corridor, I don't know, it's maybe 20 metres long, with three or four rooms along the corridor, clearing them. Thankfully, they were empty.
Yeah.
I was on my own. I don't know what the hell I would have done if they weren't, or if there was an enemy in there or whatever, or even if like there was a scared British soldier jump out of a...
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, I don't know, because I was scared, you know what I mean? I don't know how that would have turned out, so I'm glad they were empty. Got to the stairs at the end of the corridor, and there was you could see like handprints on, you know, bloody handprints on the steps, and you could see where people had been shot. I'm thinking, how have they been shot there, and then they've ended up there? And then one of the lads from the roof, who's been defending the compound pretty much on his own, sticks his head from down the top of the roof. And he's like, sir, you've got to get up here. There's more wounded. There's more people being shot up here. And I'm like, what? I still don't know what's gone on here, you know? So get up there and there's essentially there was a couple of guys who'd been shot on that stairwell and had made their way, crawled their way up to the roof, really badly hurt, shot multiple times, and I'm just thinking, what the hell are we going to do here? And as I say, you know, memories are all a bit jumbled up. I don't know exactly. I can't remember exactly what happened when, but then, we start getting contacted.
So you start getting shot at?
Yeah, we start getting shot
from outside?
Yeah. So I'm confident now that the compound's clear, that the building's clear, that, you know, I've got my medic downstairs dealing with, you know, best he can.
Yeah.
On his second ever patrol in the British Army. You crack on. My platoon sergeant's there helping him. And then I've got some really good soldiers. Because we were OMLT, they were all experienced soldiers. Mm. I think lowest rank was a lance corporal. They were outside, so what was that? I had maybe four guys securing the perimeter.
Yeah,
you know, we're not a watertight. You know, it's not watertight here.
Yeah,
you know, we can't do any Rorke's Drift efforts, but you know, I'm confident that. You know, we've got all round defence and stuff is being sorted, and we've at least got a handle on the situation. And then we start getting attacked. It's like,
and you're on this roof. You're on the roof at this.
I'm on the roof. We start getting incoming, and it's sporadic. It's not, you know, it's not anything to write. It's not like it's a concerted effort to overrun the facility, but it's just a couple of enemy, who are out there sort of going right. Let's put them under some pressure until their cavalry or the enemy cavalry arrives, and then we'll properly have a pop.
Yeah.
Which happened later on. I mean, to cut a long story short, we did the very best we could for all the lads who were hurt. And
how many lads are on the roof hurt, mate? Sorry, I think I missed it.
What, wounded?
Yeah.
Two.
So there's two lads still essentially fighting, like,
yeah,
switched on and off.
Yeah.
They're not shot, not injured.
So it turned out, I mean, fast forward slightly.
Okay, sorry.
We call in the Chinook, the MERT, the sort of flying ambulance, if you like. And, you know, good on them. You know, they landed on, and I was like, right, just, you can't let them leave. I know that it's uncertain about sort of enemy in the area and all that sort of business, and but just don't let him leave, because we've got a lot of casualties, and we need to get him. Need to get him to the back of the Chinook.
How long's that after then? Because we have fast forwarded a little bit there, haven't we?
We have, mate.
So was that about an hour later or something? Or
no. Not that. No. Yeah.
Got you.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I don't know. 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So not too long. Forward,
not too long. I was like, don't let him come off the ground, because we haven't got a lot of men here.
Is Manny still working on the lad downstairs?
No. And speaking to Manny, you know, this is something that bothers him, and, you know, it really shouldn't. I call Manny up, like, Manny, you know, you got to come and now see these guys upstairs.
Mm.
Is there anything else you can do for that lad downstairs? And he was like, no, he's still alive. And I call him upstairs, and he's working on the lads upstairs. And I come down, and the lad we pulled out has died.
Yeah.
But I check his breath. I check him. And, you know, I put my foot, sort of cheek next to his lips, and I can sort of feel his stubble and all that sort of business. And, you know, yeah, and he's gone. He's gone. So, you know, it's a bit weird. You know, what do you do? You know, it's like, you know, you see it on the movies, don't you? You close their eyes. And so I helped him close his eyes, and I said a few words over him and all that sort of business. Yeah. And, you know, told him, he wasn't on his own and all that sort of business. And, you know, I spent as long as I could with him.
Yeah.
You know, I spent a few moments with him, just to pay respects, and then I had to move on.
Yeah.
And one of these lads, one of the lads who was in battle shock. Sorry, I know I'm bouncing around, but this is how it is in my memory.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Just do what you need to do.
He was sort of clinging on to me, and I was like, right, this is a guy who needs a job. This is a guy who needs to have something to occupy him. I was like, right, listen, you know, these are your mates here, and that, you know, we need to pay them respects. We need to cover them. So go and fetch me. And I gave him like a shopping list. I was like, I want, you know, one Under Armour shirt. I want one green T-shirt. I want one brown T-shirt, so that he'd spend some time looking for it.
Yeah.
And then I want you to, you know, put green T-shirt on him, brown T-shirt on that, sort of like. So he went and was covering his mates. And, you know, I don't know, thinking back now, maybe that wasn't the right thing for him to do. Or maybe it was. Maybe it should have been his mate who was covering
Sounds
his mates.
Like,
I don't know.
It's a weird, it was an unnatural situation.
I don't know. But everyone was really busy.
Yeah.
You know, we just didn't have time or men to do all these things that you really should do. You know, you really should take time to spend a moment with a lad that's just died.
Mm.
You really should take time to cover your men.
Mm.
Not just because that's the right thing to do, but also because it's a drill. I mean, you were a soldier, you know, actually you cover your own dead, so that the effect is lessened for the other men who are coming in. All that sort of business. So it's good soldiering. But, you know, we didn't have the people. But fast forward, I think our sister call sign arrives, another one of the omelets, and they help us extract the casualties.
So the helicopter comes in.
Mm.
Yeah, that where we're at now.
Mm.
Outside the compound.
That's right, yeah. So as That's right, because I was outside the compound with a smoke grenade to signal for where the helicopter should land.
Yeah.
And as I'm about to throw smoke, our sister call sign turns up.
Yeah.
So I'm like, brilliant, you arrived just in time. Get a stretcher, get a casualty, and get them out.
How many lads are dead here?
So at this point, four are dead.
Yeah.
Three were dead when we got there. One died sort of, you know, very soon after.
Yeah.
And there's a further 9 casualties of varying different degrees.
Fuck.
Whether that's, you know, battle shock, shot in the hand, shot 7 times, shot in the stomach, yeah. Shot in the, you know.
What's that, 13? 13 blood, yeah. So you've got to extract that many people then?
Yeah, it ended up, I mean, another guy died on the chopper. So it ended up 5 dead and 9 casualties. So 14 all up.
And at this point, you still don't know what's gone on?
We've sort of pieced it together, yeah. So from the lads, from the battle shot lads and right. from the cracking soldiers who are on the roof, you know, we've sort of pieced it together, yeah. That, you know, there's been, they said, look, there's been 2 of the police who just went nuts and started shooting up the guys.
Fucking hell.
So that's what they told us. That was the information we had.
So the 2 Afghan police that was... You were they were sharing the compound with,
yeah.
Essentially, AK-4, something like that.
Yeah, some
not
AK-2s.
Not pistols, something bigger.
Yeah,
than that.
No. It was all assault rifles.
Yeah, yeah. And then they just literally sprayed the lads that were sat down and everyone else in the.
Yeah, murdered them. Yeah, yeah, murdered them.
So the helicopter's in. The extraction starts. Sorry, mate. Yeah, it's the thingy in it that word murdered him. But there we go. You're now extracting. What's happening with that situation then?
I mean, it's bonkers. So, you know, it's all hands to the pump. I said, you know, there were guys who'd been shot in the hand. They were on stretchers. Not on stretchers. They were carrying stretchers.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, you know, you almost feel that, you know, if you're in a war zone and you get shot, that's you're out, you know.
Yeah.
You don't then expect to, you know, right, you're on the corner of that stretcher, off you go, big lad. I mean, we didn't have enough stretchers for a start.
Yeah,
you know, we were a small team of 7 yeah. guys, and we had all of these casualties and being shot at, and so we had to maintain security and treat the casualties and extract the casualties and sort of relay back to it and coordinate. It was bonkers. It was a bonkers half hour, hour, I don't know. And and so I remember being up on the roof and some of the positions, some of the machine gun positions on the roof, we'd create, the guys, again, great soldiers, had created sort of obscuration screen, so essentially like Hessian,
yeah,
just Hessian drapes, so that enemy looking in can't really see where the firing positions are. And I remember just getting out my knife and cutting down the Hessian to turn it into a makeshift stretcher. It was that sort of
crude and fundamental.
Yeah, it was like, yeah. Right, how are we going to get? I mean, the 2 guys on the roof. Big guys. One of them was a Fijian.
Yeah.
And they just don't make small Fijians, do they? You know, they're all big lads. And it was like, right, well, how are we going to get these lads down? I mean, they were very, very far from walking wounded. How are we going to get them down these stairs? And it was right, okay, we'll start cutting the obscuration and get them on that. So yeah, it was quite desperate.
Did everyone get out? As in, wounded. How many helicopter trips did it take?
Well, we got everyone we could on one chopper.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you've got to prioritise. You've got to go, right, well, you know, if you've been shot multiple times in the stomach, you're getting on the chopper. If you've been shot in the hand, I'm sorry, big lad, you're going to wait.
And the lads who are dead, they just get left to the end, because obviously there's a triage.
Yeah.
I'm not questioning you, brother. I'm just questioning it, and just making it clear. So there's a triage that happens in hospitals, it happens on the battlefield, and the battlefield can be a bit more brutal than a hospital, but actually the same rules apply, and there is an order of kind of treatment.
Listen, you know, if you've passed, if you're dead, you know, if you put you on the chopper, you're taking up a bed space for somebody that really, really badly needs it. But obviously I've been relaying messages back to HQ and, you know, what was going on. And so when our sister unit turned up, our sister call sign, as I say, and about another seven guys, they brought you know, the correct equipment for dealing with the dead.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, just to not to counter your point there about you know, treatment of the dead and priorities and triage. But I remember sort of how much respect we gave for them.
Yeah.
You know, these were our comrades, these were our soldiers. And I remember, you know, you could look at it and go, oh, what, their bodies, are they okay? Yeah. You know, just get them back. But we didn't. We remember saying to the lads, listen, whatever you do, don't stack them up.
Yeah.
They're not to be stacked. Each guy needs his own position in that vehicle.
Yeah.
Each guy needs to be looked after. Each guy needs to be given some respect. So don't be stacking them up in the back.
Yeah.
And they really didn't. And really just, I don't know, they weren't, you know, they were looked after.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. We're gonna, let's. I don't think we need to talk too much more about that now. And if just for the recording, we're gonna just pause, I think, because I can't move us on from that point. I just wanted to put a little break in that conversation there. I just thought it was for me to push and pull that conversation past that point straight away would have been disrespectful to one David and I think the guys that were injured during that. Let's get straight back into it. So the date now is the 15th of November 2009. Normally on a kind of episode, on a podcast, and a conversation, this would be the thing that takes up the majority of it. But why was that day so significant?
So we, as horrific as the 3rd of November had been, we still had a job to do. We couldn't stop soldiering. So we were out on the ground again. We were doing our job. The battle group, the company had just taken over a patch of new ground, hard won, big battle, and basically pushed the, what we call the FLET, the forward line of enemy troops, had pushed that back several hundred metres back. And our job then was to patrol this new one area and make sure it wasn't re-infiltrated by the enemy. So we undertook an aggressive fighting patrol called an advance to contact, which, you know, it's a fancy word. You know, we went out to pick a fight. And find the enemy, fight the enemy, make sure he doesn't come back on our new bit of ground. We did that, made contact with the enemy. We were in a firefight. And you know, when you're fighting, people get hurt. And it'd been a really busy period for us. We'd been in a few scrapes. We'd dealt with a lot of casualties, not just on the 3rd, but on other days. And this day was my turn to get hurt, and I wasn't lying down, but I was in a prone position, low to the ground. And a round came in, one whistle right past my head, and you know, anyone that's been close to a round, you know, has been shot out a lot. you know, knows when they're close and when and when they're just rounds flying around, whatever. This one was very close. And the next one slammed into my chest. So it entered just below my collarbone. And then travelled sort of lengthways down my torso.
So you're laying, in a prone position, laying down, it's gone in.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's gone the length of my torso.
Yeah.
And then hit sort of my back ribs, my front ribs, and come to rest in my right lung. So on its way through, it's nicked my axial artery. It's damaged my brachial plexus. A junction of nerves in my armpit. It's punctured my lung. And so I'm bleeding very heavily internally, and I've got a sucking chest wound. So I end up with what's called a pneumohemothorax, where basically your chest cavity fills with blood and air. And so my good lung, my left lung, was struggling to open.
Yeah. It pushes against it basically makes the other lung a lot smaller, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the room required to open the lung is filled with blood and air.
Yeah.
And so it can't open. So you end up sort of like doing a really good impression of like a carp and just no air is going in.
Mm. And then still contact, what happens then? So you've been shot.
Yeah.
Then what?
So, yeah, I realise I'm in what we call the killing zone. Got to extract yourself, if you can, from the killing zone. Intelligence had said, you know, stay out of the ditches. If you get contacted, stay out of the ditches, which is completely counterintuitive for an infantryman. You know, like, where's cover? Let's get in that cover. But because, you know, what they were doing was contacting and then laying IEDs, improvised explosive devices, in obvious cover. So you'd get in the cover and they'd blow you up.
Yeah.
But I was like, I need to get in cover. Yeah. I sort of rolled my useless body into this ditch, which was just full of water and piss, and immediately sank to the bottom. This brachial plexus injury meant that my entire right side was useless.
Yeah.
And you know, we were carrying, I don't know, 35 kilos on our back, weapon and body armor and helmet, and I just sank. And I'm thinking, brilliant, well, now I'm going to drown in piss and shit. And I just feel this next to me. And it's my Fijian corporal who'd crossed that killing ground, you know, to get to me. And dived in after me. And was just pulling me up. Like I say, they don't make
it's a good job he was small. Big, mate, because you're massive.
But yeah, I'm massive. But they, as I said before, they don't make small Fijians.
Mm.
Big lad, pulled me up. And then another one of my lads had crossed
can you, the ground. Can you remember that, then? That
psh, yeah, psh, mate, I'm completely...
And you're drowning at the time.
Yeah. Psh, psh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, everything was pretty clear at this point.
Yeah.
You know, you
yeah.
can sort of, you know, good sense of clarity, you know, when it's, there wasn't too much to concentrate on this point, you know, sort of pain and immediate surroundings. And feel him sort of, you know, that splash next to me. And it's Manny. Manny's coming after me as well.
Yeah.
And they're both, we're up to our necks in water. And they're sort of like trying to strip, get this body armour off me, get everything off me so they can get to the wounds. And they're pulling me and pushing me and moving everything around. They can see the wound on my front, but they're sort of like turning me around, trying to find the exit wound, because obviously, you know, the exit wounds, you know, the entry wound was, you know, about 7.62 millimeters across, not very big,
yeah.
But you know, they're looking for the exit wound, which is about the size of a fist. It wasn't there because the round was retained, which actually, on one side, it's good because it means you haven't got a massive gaping wound.
Mm.
But on the other side, it's bad because basically all the energy required to push that piece of metal, you know, to whatever Mach 2, I've basically just swallowed and absorbed it. But yeah, they sort of did everything they could. Can't give me morphine because of a chest injury. I ended up, the blood really filled in my chest and I stopped breathing a couple of times. And I just remember Manny just grabbing me. I'm sort of lying on the floor, just bloody useless. And I remember Manny just picking me up and he says that he didn't know what he was doing. He was just out of frustration shaking me because he couldn't do anything else. And he was just come on, boss, come on, and shaking me. But actually, thinking about it, that shaking probably saved my life because it just moved
it around and moved the blood. Yeah,
and just a bit of room, just let the lung open a little bit and another breath and another breath.
Yeah.
And then actually it was a US call sign came, picked me up, Pedro. Black Hawk helicopter came, landed on. We're still in contact to this point, so brave pilots again, good lads. Landed on, put me in the back, and I remember as it was lifting off, stopped breathing again, and I'm like, I'm begging the guy with my eyes, I can't breathe, because obviously I can't tell him.
Yeah.
I'm just signalling. Because I'm strapped down as well. I can't even point to my mouth or anything like that. I was thinking, shit, this is going to be a really stupid way to die. It's I've just been shot, nearly drowned, and I'm going to die because I can't tell the bloke I can't breathe. And I need to sit up and move my lung or whatever. And then I just remember I remember how he smelt. I remember, he'd been in the back of a chopper in Afghanistan for probably 3 days straight, and I can just smell him now. And he's sort of leaning across me, and just this knife goes into my side and starts cutting. And I'm just,
Is it painful or relief?
Oh, mate, the pain.
Yeah.
I've basically been stabbed in the chest. And he's cutting.
Yeah. Shot, drowned, now stabbed.
Yeah, I know. It's really, really bad day at the office, eh?
Yeah.
Join the infantry.
Yeah. See the world.
Yeah, see the world. Meet interesting people. Yeah, shoot them. Then his little finger goes in, and then a tube goes in, and I just... Then there's the relief as the blood just drains, and I can open my lungs again and...
Breathe. We need to move us. This is where I can move us a little bit, and it's appropriate. We, you get Casivac'd out, Medivac back to the UK. You spend time at Selly Oak, with all the recovery and all the rest of it. There's some things we need to touch on today, and I'm going to gloss over some things now, mate, just really quick. You get posted back, you then go to Catterick, and basically, in your words, in this conversation we had, it was a kind of a bit of a slap in the face for someone who's... And I'm kind of glossing over it, mate, but it was the best thing for you. You was then getting a lot of care, and welfare was top-notch, and it was, on hindsight, really was the best place for you to be. For physically and psychologically, you was getting, quite rightly, a lot of therapy. 2011, you started mountaineering and you went to the Alps. And just could you kind of talk about the next... These tons were missing. But just talk about that recovery, because obviously some psychological problems, injury and illness. Just go for it, mate. Everything around the mountaineering, everything around all that side of things you just run with.
Listen, I mean,
take your time, mate, just take your time. I've just been told we've got more time, so
that's good,
let's go.
Okay. I mean, I've got to get at work, we'll have to wrap it up. I've got a bit of time, mate.
Yeah,
make time for you.
Yeah, great, thanks.
I guess it kind of makes sense to sort of say, there was a guy I was at uni with called Martin Hewitt. And he was also an infantryman, para, rudge. And he'd also been shot in the chest.
At the same time?
No. It's an occupational hazard. and I hadn't seen him for years. And he, I was in my bed in intensive care at Selly Oak, you know, in a world of it. And in walked Martin. And do you know what? I'd been given quite a lot of ketamine on the aircraft. Yeah. And I went on some crazy, crazy trip. You know, that's another chat for another time. Not a good one either. You know,
not really.
Yeah, I wouldn't advise taking that recreationally. I mean, you know, mate, it was horrible. But I woke up in intensive care, and my doctor was in intensive care, was a guy I knew from uni.
Hmm.
And then in walks Martin, who I'd known from uni.
Hmm.
And I was thinking, and in my head, I was like, have I really died? Is this what it's like? Like, you just see mates from the past who come, yeah. You know, I was like, it was all, yeah, kind of weird drug-addled brain sort of thing. But anyway, Martin comes in and...
The Scouser, is he a Scouser?
Yeah. So he probably wasn't coming to see me. He was probably seeing if there's anything worth robbing. and he started telling me, we got friends again. We connected again. And he started telling me about this expedition he was going on. To the North Pole. There was him who'd been shot in the chest and was paralysed down the right hand side. There was a cav officer called Guy who'd lost a leg in an incident in Afghanistan. There was a para private soldier called Jacko who lost an arm to an RPG in Afghan, and a guy called Steve, a Welshman who'd broken his back in a bombing in Afghanistan, was told he'd never walk again. And these four idiots thought that they'd be the perfect team to reach the North Pole. and Prince Harry agreed, so went along with them. Yeah. Like, all right. And I watched them and was just motivated, you know, inspired, probably is a better word, inspired by their actions. And I thought, yeah, I want a bit of that.
Mm.
From a completely selfish point of view, I want a bit of that. Looks mega. So as soon as I was well enough, you know, to 2011, so two years on, you know, yeah, I got involved in mountaineering. There was an expedition coming up to have a crack at Everest, and in the process, in the run up to Everest, we climbed the highest mountain in Italy. We climbed the eighth highest mountain in the world, 8,163 meters high.
Yeah.
And yeah, we had a good old crack at Everest. We didn't succeed, but you know, we had a good old crack. And throughout that process, I came to realize that there's something in this. There's something in sport as a vehicle for recovery.
Mm.
And it's not a revelation that I've come up with. Obviously, you know, this is what the basis of the Paralympic Games and everything like that.
Yeah.
But this is what I realised behind it all. And that actually, with any injury, whether you've been shot in Afghan or you've had a car accident or you've been diagnosed with cancer or whatever, you know, there's always going to be a physical, a social, and a psychological element to that.
Okay.
And sport is a fantastic way of combating those impacts physically.
All three.
Yeah, physically, yeah. You're more active. If you're more active, you're going to heal better. Socially, you're back in that team environment. You're back with your muckers. It's a supportive and positive team environment. Psychologically, you're all moving towards, you know, a single goal. You can break down your future into bite-sized chunks of walk again, run again, climb a small hill, climb a bigger hill, climb Everest. You know, you can break down your future. You know, it's goal-centric. All these things, it's just good juju.
Mm.
And so then going through that experience, that's, you know, I took that into my next job. When I left the army and went to work for the Royal Foundation.
We, before we get there, because I think it's worth talking, you know, we talk about that social and the physical side and the psychological. There's things that you, because you wrote a book and published the book, Hellman to the Himalayas. What was that, 2013, 14?
Yeah, it came out in 2014. Yeah.
And there was bits that you missed out of there for various reasons. And I think it's really important that we cover look, we've covered PTSD and the variants of it. This symptom of it. I'd really like you to explain.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as you said, you know, I wrote this book back then. I think it's you know, it's safe to say that, you know, there was still a lot of stigma when I wrote the book, and a lot of that was self-imposed stigma.
Mm.
Like, oh, I'm not sure how much I want to open up. But actually, one of the reasons why I wrote the book was because I was going through therapy at the time, and I was fed up with changing therapists and having to tell my story time and time and time again. So actually, I wrote it down, and at the first session of a new therapist, I'd give them the manuscript and go, "There you go. You know, read it, and we'll start again next week or whatever." And one of the therapists went, "Actually, this material is really good, and it would help other people to hear your story."
Hmm.
And I just feel that I missed an opportunity there to actually really help other people. Put it this way. For a long time, I just thought I was going completely mad. And that was terrifying.
Mm.
You know, the symptoms I was experiencing, I thought that if I told them to other people, they might take my kids away.
Yeah.
They'd fill me full of drugs. They'd lock me in a padded cell. They'd do all this sort of stuff. And you know, things like, you know, extreme paranoia, you know, and weird sort of paranoid thoughts about, you know, people laughing at me at work, you know, an infantryman that gets shot, what an idiot, you know.
Mm.
You know, okay, if you get blown up, not your fault, you know, but you get shot, you shouldn't really get shot. You know, you've been trained how to act in a firefight, and you shouldn't get shot. Clearly a bad soldier. All these sorts of things. I thought people in the mess were laughing at me. I thought, you know, it really paranoid. And I just think that if I could talk back to my past self and offer some advice, then I'd feel a lot better. And sort of explain, if I knew then what I know now about the symptoms, about the mechanisms, about the psychology, then maybe that would make more sense. And you know, and I know we've spoken before about sort of one particular symptom, and that was sort of this feeling that one of the lads was following me around.
One of the lads that died.
Yeah. So the lad that we pulled out, me and Coops, I just felt, I felt that he was always there. And either if I was sort of driving at night,
yeah,
he'd be sitting in the back of the car, you know, brushing my teeth, you know, he'd be on the stairs.
Could you see him, or what was
it? Yeah. I mean, like out of the corner of my eye, yeah.
Yeah.
Or if it was dark, like there'd be a shadow that, you know, it wasn't like I'm looking at you now.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't
like a ghost.
Yeah, like a spectre sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't psychotic.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, I was completely, you know, I got it. But in my, you know, and you've spoken about this before on different podcasts about how the brain works in trauma, and actually sort of, I think the phrase you've used in the past is that, you know, PTSD in itself, you know, is a memory disorder.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, if you think about it, if you think about, you know, that situation, which I described earlier, hugely complicated, hugely dynamic, very fast pace, you're under threat, you haven't got all the information, you know, you're in a position of command, so there's a responsibility that you should know this, you should behave like that, you should do this. So there's a lot of onus, there's a lot of responsibility, and you need to get it right. If you don't get it right, people die, or more people die, or you die, or yeah, it's a complicated situation. It's trauma. And traumatic memories aren't laid down in the same way.
And because in this situation, for depending on your worldview, this is either an act of war, but for you as an individual, this is essentially mass murder.
Yeah, okay.
Memory is mass murder.
Yeah, and so there's all sorts of conflicting ethical and moral and...
Yeah, but the brain, I'm saying in relation to this conversation right now,
yeah,
this memory is trying to... I think you're going to...
It's trying to compartmentalize it, yeah. Right? So the brain loves to file things away, and it loves to sort of go, right, okay, well, yeah, I can make sense of this situation because it's a bit like this or it's a bit like that. And it makes these sort of connections to previous incidents, experiences, environments, whatever. Because I had never, ever been in an environment like this before. I don't think many people have.
Mm.
My brain had nowhere to file this away. So it sticks in its own file by itself.
Mm.
Trauma, November 3rd, 2009. And the brain doesn't like that. It wants to put it somewhere. So it relives it and relives it and relives it. And what's more about the memories is because it's so busy, because it's so traumatic, the memories aren't laid down in perhaps the correct order or the correct sequence or all the information might not be right. So when I was saying earlier, and I go, oh yeah, to my recollection, this happened and that happened.
Yeah.
I can't say for certain. It's all jumbled up. Again, the brain doesn't like that. It doesn't like a non-complete story. So it replays it and replays it and replays it.
Yeah.
And until it can get the story right in its own file and can make connections.
So where's this filing?
So in the way I understand it, and this is, you know, as I say, gospel according to Wiseman, I'm not a psychologist, but this spectre that's following me around, that's the only way I can describe it. That's the only way the brain can make sense of it, is that it's a ghost, is that it's a haunting.
Yeah. Because she was taught there is a file for horror movies.
Yeah.
There is a file where, as a child, you was taught that ghosts are scary. So the only, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the only way this mass murder trauma memory is trying to get filed, the only category it can fit in is basically horror movies.
Horror. Yeah. Horror.
And
terror.
The flashback
is
coming back to you as, in the form of a ghost, a spectre kind of thing.
That's it. It's the only way it can make sense of it. For this particular symptom, yeah. But I don't know. I mean, yeah, that's how I make sense of it. And yeah, I mean, I could talk for ages about how I dealt with that and the therapies. I mean, professional help really, really helped.
Mm.
So EMDR really helped.
What's that?
I mean, it's a form of therapy.
Yeah.
That helps process memory.
Okay.
Helps the filing system.
Yeah.
And yeah, and now I'm sort of loads better.
It's it's such a good narrative that last 5 minutes. And if you haven't listened to episode 4 with Dr. Walter Boozer-Taylor, he really talks about what PTSD is and basically what you what you've just described there. I'll put in the show notes what EMDR stands for and give an explanation and some links and whatnot for those that might need it. So now we go back to where we kind of started a second ago. You got discharged in 2013 for both psychological or on both psychological and physical grounds with your essentially your shoulder and you was diagnosed with PTSD. You then started work for the Royal Foundation.
Yeah.
And you was project manager in you just go over.
Do you mind if I talk about a few other symptoms first?
Yes.
Is that
no,
okay?
No, you go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I just think, you know,
I could
talk about Invictus. Sorry, this is to edit out. You can do that, can't you?
Yeah, but I'll probably just leave this in because it's
okay. It's just, you know, I could talk about sport, I could talk about Invictus, but I think that's all been documented. What hasn't, what, you know, the as I said, you know, the reason why sort of I wanted to come and talk to you today is sort of to fill in those gaps and sort of like speak to myself sort of 7 years ago, and yeah. and there must be other people out there who were in the position I was in 7 years ago who were thinking they're going mad, and you're not. You know, these, you know, and you'll hear that phrase over and over again, and so it's frustrating. These are normal reactions to abnormal situations, and it's the normal way in which your brain is healing and trying to make sense of it. And there's just so much, you know, when people talk about PTSD, there's that, there's almost like a preconception about what that is, and it's about, oh yeah, lads who get startled easy, and when a car backfires, like any car has ever backfired in the past, you know, 40 years, you know, so that's the example everyone gives. And oh yeah, you might get, you know, lashed up and punch your missus or something like that. And, you know, those are the preconceptions. And there's just, I don't know, because I wasn't necessarily doing that, I just didn't think, yeah, this isn't me. That's, it's not where I fit in. And there's sort of, I do think there's a lack of understanding. That lack of understanding isn't good for the guys, and it's not good for, you know, general understanding. But what it meant for me is having to have a busy mind all the time. Like not being able to relax even for a second, because as soon as you relax, something comes into your mind that you really, really don't want to be there. Something that you don't want to see, something that you don't want to smell, something that you don't want to feel, and or relive. And it's having to be busy all the time, and that's just so tiring. I, you know, lived with fatigue for years.
Really?
You know, having to be busy, having to stay active, not being able to relax. Just, and that, yeah, you know, living with somebody who follows you around that you don't want, that's horrible. But you sort of get used to that.
Yeah.
But fatigue, it's just draining on everything. It's insidious.
On the family as well.
On a family, on work, on everything. You know, and the times of day when you should be relaxing, you know, when you're trying to go to bed, actually they become the worst times of day, because you know the pattern of it. That's when those feelings are being followed are going to be. That's when you're feeling vulnerable. And so, you know, actually, you know, I don't mean that from a sort of feeling like a victim, but you should feel vulnerable when you're going to bed. You know, you know, you make yourself, you know, all cozy and you know, you're in a safe space, so it's fine to be vulnerable. But actually, as you're relaxing, as you're dropping off, as your mind is relaxing, that's when those intrusive thoughts come in. And so you almost dread going to bed. And then you start making patterns, unhealthy habits about going to bed and obsessing over things that you need to do in the pattern to make sure that those images don't come in, or having to be so exhausted when you go to bed or when you go to sleep that there's no transition point from, oh, I'll just relax now until my eyes close and gently go to sleep. None of that. You've got to be either exhausted or drunk. Right. And that's just unhealthy. And, you know, even when you start doing the therapy, and the therapy's amazing, it's great, it works. You know, it's hard work, mate. So we talked about EMDR. After every EMDR session I've ever had, and I've had dozens and dozens, you feel like you've been in a pub fight, you know, for a day afterwards.
Yeah.
It's hard slogs. And I think that's why a lot of lads say, oh, that, I tried that, it didn't work. Because, lads, you need to crack on with it for months, and it's tough yards. But, you know, if you're tough enough to go to war and you're tough enough to go through all that, I guarantee you're tough enough to smash the therapy as well. So
it's the bravery of it, isn't it?
It's brave, mate.
Brian Wood talks about it. Look, military cross winner, he went to the door twice before knocking.
Yeah.
Literally put his hand up to knock on the door, walked away, came back, and then knocked.
And there's a lad who will, you know, lead a bayonet charge.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's you're right, mate. And it's courage, and it's hard yards. So it's sticking with it. But even when you get that, even when you have that therapy and you have those tools, the thing with the thing with this PTSD is it lives in the back of your mind. Mm. It's always ticking away. That's why you've got to keep busy. And it wants to come to the surface. And I know I'm talking like it's got its own personality and something, but it almost does.
Mm.
It's kind of a wicked, mischievous personality. It wants to come to the surface. It wants oxygen. It wants you to talk about it. It wants you to think about it, because then the brain can file it.
Mm.
That's why it's in your dreams. That's why it's in your conversations when you're not expecting them to be in a conversation. We could be having a normal conversation about wallpapering and you don't know how you've got there, but 5 minutes later, you're talking about Afghanistan.
Mm.
You're like, how are we talking about this? Because the brain needs to bring it to the surface, right, so it can file it.
Yeah, that is really... I knew a lad, who was in the Falklands, and he used to speak about it all the time, to the point where it pissed blokes off.
Yeah.
And you're like, why does he keep speaking about it? And what you just said then is the first time I've ever even considered that.
Yeah. It's the memory. The brain doesn't like that it's a file sitting on its own, and it needs to give it oxygen in order to make those connections and file it. Mm. It's living with fear and embarrassment. It's this embarrassment that you've got this thing.
Mm.
It is embarrassing. You know, I was an infantryman.
Mm.
You know, I was hard as nails, nothing's going to break me. And now I'm sort of like having to pull over in the car because I'm crying.
Mm.
What? That's not cool.
Mm.
That's not what you should be doing. You know, you shouldn't have to sleep with the light on. You're a grown man. That embarrassment. But there's a reason for that. You know, and it's almost like if I was going to give myself... you know, any sort of advice, and it sounds soft, and all you want to do is punish yourself, because from a military aspect, we are self-critical human beings. We go, oh, I should have done that, I should have done this. But actually, every now and again, you've got to show yourself a bit of self-compassion.
Mm.
And the way I've thought about it is, you know, as a young commander, if I had a soldier sitting across the desk from me who was coming with these issues, how would I speak to him?
Mm.
And I'd go through that conversation. How would I speak to young Private Wiseman?
Yeah.
As opposed to, how am I talking to myself, Captain Wiseman? Yeah, yeah. And it was two different conversations, and that's not right.
Yeah.
You should talk to yourself and think about yourself the same way that you talk to your best mate or a private soldier or anybody that, you know, anybody that comes to you with issues. Self-compassion.
Mate, it's quality. Do you need... I'm laughing because there's so much more we haven't covered, mate.
Yeah, I know, mate. Yeah.
But I'm really glad you kind of stopped me there mid-flow and got that out, because that's... again, that's why you were on today, and that's why you were so adamant you was coming on. Let me scan over a few things, because the busyness really was, and I'm going to skim this. Mm. You, Prince Harry, three others essentially set up the Invictus Games. I'm going to briefly go over this, mate. You founded it, you helped manage the first one, set it up. You've swam in it three times, 14, 16, 17. You captained the UK side in 16. In a kind of couple of sentences, why is the Invictus Games been so important to you and to many others?
I mean, it's worth saying I was part of the team that helps.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. Yeah. 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 I'm just kind of big time sensationalizing this bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Set it up.
Yeah, set it up, founded it. Yeah, yeah. There we go. Yeah, no, part of the team. But why is the Invictus game so important? It goes back to those issues I said before. You know, any injury, there's always going to be a physical, social, and psychological element.
Mm.
And the Invictus games... is sort of that massive shining light for everybody that has had a serious injury or illness while serving, and can bring everybody into that positive team environment that sport offers and promotes. And what we found, not just with the Invictus Games, but everything we do through the Endeavour Fund, all the different endeavours, not just Invictus, is that almost like your story with Brian there about knocking on the door. No one wants to knock on that door of the therapist and sort of go, hi, I need some help. that's a, I mean, that takes massive balls. And Brian's obviously got, you know, a wheelbarrow that he has to wheel around for his balls.
I love that.
But, like, most people don't have those, don't have that. But sport gives you almost the vehicle, almost gives you the permission to create a supportive environment where you can take those smaller steps.
Yeah.
To help. It's not about boldly rocking up to someone's door, knock, knock, knock. Yeah. It might start with, you know, a conversation with a mate that you've got to know over a few training sessions, and you've built up trust, and you're doing it parallel to the sport which you're undertaking.
Safe, secure environment, and if a lot of good stuff starts with a conversation, I know a lot of good stuff's going to start and hopefully help people with this conversation. Do you have anything else to kind of to finish up on?
Yeah, I mean, the I guess my parting shot is, you know, the stuff we've carried on with doing with the Royal Foundation, and it's exactly what you've just said there, mate, is, you know, I'm sure lots of people would have seen the Heads Together campaign and all the programs that are coming from that amazing campaign. And you're right, all of that starts with the idea that with a conversation, with opening up about talking about all these sorts of issues and accepting that we all have mental health. Mental health isn't something that you have when it's broken and you need to react to it, something that's to be fixed. We all have it in the same way that we all have physical health, and it's something that needs to be looked after, not just something that you look after when you're poorly or you've got poor mental health. You know, let's promote an environment where, you know, the good management of good mental health, in the same way that, you know, we look after our physical health, even when we're feeling fully fit, we still go down to the gym. Well, some of us do, mate. I'm looking across.
Yeah, you've seen it. Yeah. I've got a little pod.
But there, you know, let's promote these conversations. And I just, you know, I applaud what you're doing with these podcasts, and sort of go, you know, you're providing that platform which normalizes these types of conversations and allows people like myself, like Si Harmer, like Brian Wood, to not just document, not just archive, but almost give other people who've had similar experiences almost the permission to have their own conversations and hopefully find some healing in that.
Mate, thanks so much, and we'll leave it there.